Greetings and salutations, everyone. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 4 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and chat with each other and teach each other and learn from each other and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you all for joining me once again this particular Sunday night at 8 p.m. This is our Labor Day edition of the Technical Net. I will drop and follow up with the usual links. If you want to reach me via email, that would be either for mailbag questions. Those are questions that normally are asked during the Technical Net, but you may not be available during the Technical Net, so you email them to me and I read them. If it's interesting, we discuss them, and you can either listen to it on an internet-based audio stream, or you can listen to it on an archive file of past Technical Nets. And learn a few things. It used to be a very popular aspect of this Technical Net, but it's kind of gone to sleep for many, many years. I think I've gotten one or two questions in about 2-3 years these days, where it was not unusual to have 3 questions a night. Anyway, also, if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always searching for TechNet puzzles to stimulate discussion, learn new things. We had one just last week, and I hope people enjoyed it. I don't have one tonight. They're as rare as hen's teeth, so if you have one, share it with me, and if I think it's a good grist for the mill, I will spread it about. Or if you have a topic that you have expertise in that's come up in the news, something happens, and it's a technical, has a technical nature, and you have expertise, and you want to share it, contact me and tell me, and we're more than happy to give you a little opportunity to expand on the subject. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a space or NASA-related story and give his opinion, of course, you can email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But again, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. We also offer you a link page of interesting articles and YouTube that I've collected over the previous week. They remain on the link page for years. So if you're so inclined at any moment of insomnia or boredom in the middle of the week, just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. We have a chat room available. It was very active last week. You can get to it by typing in chat.ac2gs.com into your browser. And as I mentioned earlier, we offer an audio stream of the Technical Net, so if you are not within radio distance or don't have a radio, but you do have an internet connection, you can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream. And I keep it live the rest of the week, so if you want to listen to the Glen Oaks repeater over the internet, you can just type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream in real time. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called AmateurRadio.tv. It has over 1 million visitors. And he has archives of our Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of very smart, knowledgeable amateur radio operators who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. Their wisdom remains in the archives. You can listen to it whenever you wish, so please avail yourself of it. So let me drop, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay, a standard routine operating session tonight. We will have questions from the audience. People are urged to come up with either questions or comments or topics for discussion. Preferably the first few should be amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio repeater, but as everyone no doubt knows by I will accept any particular aspect of science and technology and do the best that I can with it. So if you have any questions, get ready to hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. Once again, I have queued up a interesting antenna that John from Florida and 2ZC mentioned a few weeks ago. He hasn't been on Echolink lately, so I've been kind of postponing follow-up discussion of it. It's in the link page, so you can look at it. It looks to me like a weirdly sized G5RV, but it is called a two-element collinear dipole. So if John is here this week, we will discuss it. If he's not, we'll put it in the hamper for hopefully next week. And if he doesn't come back in the next few weeks, we'll probably just retire this particular antenna design for the time being. So anyway, the questions should take us to about 10:15, hopefully, and Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report, which will take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the following week. That's my plans if the laws of physics and all manner of things continue working right and I don't continually fall out of All-Star like I did last Sunday. We'll see how things work out. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Limar Technical Net. We're open for business, so if anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, preferably the first few should be amateur radio related if you can. Please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign and your first name.
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. I'm Charlie. Good morning, Roy. Good evening, Roy.
And
hello, Charlie.
And Wesley, non-radio related.
Charlie and Wes recognize. Charlie, are you just saying hello, or do you have a question or a comment for tonight?
I have a question.
Okay, very good. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Please hit that push to talk and ID and give me your first name. Okay, well, once again, we're going to be starting a little on the slow side. I hope as the night progresses, there will be more questions or comments or topics for discussion, but we will see what we will see. So, Charlie, what's your question for tonight?
I bought a Kenwood TS-440S, 100-watt high-frequency radio. I need to know what kind of antenna should I put on this thing?
It depends upon a lot of things. It depends upon what frequency you would like to work and what kind of area you have access to. And if you're going to elevate it or if you're going to put it on the ground, there's a lot of variables, and antenna is one of the last things that people can do almost anything and everything, whereas there's a finite number of manufactured radios available for people to buy with the use of their credit card. Your imagination is your limit with antennas, since fundamentally many of them are simply just the different varieties of placing wire in of different length and different patterns. So my first question would be, do you happen to know what bands you're primarily interested in being able to transmit on?
I go on the high frequency and the U and ultra high.
So, okay, well, that's kind of a little bit of everything. You got to understand that high frequency is kind of a relative term. If it had to be named today, my guess would be that they would come up with something a little bit more precise. High frequency just means somewhere between 160 meters and 6 meters. So Do you want to work all of those bandwidths, or do you have a particular, 20 meters or 40 meters or 10 meters specifically in mind?
I'd like to try a little bit of both, a little bit of everything.
Okay, Charlie, so like all of us, you're a little bit greedy. The problem is the laws of physics kind of don't shine on greedy people like ourselves. The more bands you want an antenna to operate, the more compromises you tend to need to make, and the more poorly they work on the individual bands. Now, there's a whole bunch of different multi-band designs. Very few of them go from 160 to 6. So you're still going to probably have to kind of settle for something in the middle, like 80 to 10 or something. You can go with a fan dipole. You can go with a multi-trap antenna, a G5RV. I'm not a big fan of G5RVs. Doublets, which are non-resonant dipoles, where you tune it with an antenna tuner, preferably either at the antenna site, antenna feed, or through an open wire transmission line with little loss. So there's a whole bunch of multi-band compromise antennas. Then you have to settle down with the option of, is this going to be preferably mounted on the ground, or are you going to elevate it above the ground? And how high above the ground are you planning to elevate it?
I'm looking to put it on my roof, and there are not many high buildings around me, so I'm trying to go at least 100 miles, and I'm curious to see what I can get.
Yes, Paul.
I went on the chat room. I posed the question over there. Does the 440S have an antenna tuner to it, or is it one of the ones without it? That's number one. And by the way, I have that radio. That's what I want to know. Back to you, Ron.
It has the antenna tuner.
Oh, okay, very good. I didn't want to double, that's why I was going back to Roy, Charlie. Yeah, okay. Well, I've used a number of different antennas over the years. I had a homebrew two-element for 10 meters. That worked good. I had a rotator on that. And I've used a number of different dipoles. And right now I have two antennas attached to it. With the antenna switcher, I can switch back and forth. And they're both dipoles. And one is for 80 meters, so it's 134 feet long. And I have it cut for pretty much for the CW portion of the band. But it works good on phone as well. And then, I know Roy's not a big fan of the G5RV, but I have one of those. Not the big one. They call it the Junior, so it's not this big, long contraption. That works very good. I got that from Radio Oasis Company in California. And that's pretty much it. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, what happens is that radio, the original owner, he got very sick, and his son put it out there on the club. I belong to another club, and what can you tell me this is worth?
I can't do. I don't know. You know? I know it was big money when I bought it in 1986. So that's not going to help you in today's money. I don't know. I've got some issues with mine, so I wouldn't even sell it the way it is. For me, I wouldn't want to give somebody that kind of headache. I'm used to it. I get around it. But yeah, it's great radio. I've had it for decades. Roy?
Yep, AC2GS there. You might, Charlie, want to go to eBay. Sometimes you can get, you can't get a definite value for something. Some people are crazy and try to sell things three or four times the price, and others are trying to steal from you and they don't even have the product and they offer it at a low price. But you get a good number of people trying to sell roughly the same age of the model, and you pick up a vague idea of what the price level is. And there are some other amateur radio related sites that sell used gear. Unfortunately, you sort of have the same problem. Some of them are thieves who stole the picture off of a website and they don't even own it, and they're just trying to figure out a way to steal from you. But the idea is not to buy the radio, it's just to get a rough approximation of the acceptable prices out there, so you can get an idea what the price is. But I mean, the bottom line is there's a lot of compromise antennas that are available that sort of do what you want. They're not going to do UHF. It's very difficult to get an antenna that's good for both UHF and HF. So you're going to have to split your plans in half, get yourself a nice HF multi-band antenna, one of the many options available. One that I've had success with over the years has been fan dipoles. You may have to kind of tune them a little bit, but there are fan dipoles that are capable of operating on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, which is pretty good. And they're not that expensive, 100 and change. You can build them yourself if you're so inclined. The trouble is, like I said, they are a fan dipole, so you need a attachment for the center and for both sides. If you have something to tie it to on one side and the other, you can do rather well with something like a fan dipole. But there are a lot of other options out there. For the UHF, VHF, I would just get the standard collinear antenna, or a Comet or a Diamond, a GP3 or a 6 or something. And the higher you can mount it, the farther you'll be able to reach, because UHF and VHF is very much a point-to-point mode of transmission.
Hey, Roy, comment?
Certainly.
I might have missed something. Why are we talking about UHF? That radio doesn't go there.
Oh, okay, because he mentioned that he wanted an antenna that did HF and UHF.
No, I think the best you could do is six meters, which I never tried. You know, but no 2 meters, no 440. I wish, no, it's strictly really an HF band, HF band transceiver.
Oh, okay, maybe he wants to use the UHF aspect on his present radio, which is at least capable of VHF. So Charlie, according to Paul, I'm not familiar with this particular model. He says it doesn't operate above HF. So why do you want an antenna that operates above the capability of the radio that you're talking about?
I don't know. Maybe I misspoke. I'm still new at this business.
Okay, so it's basically an HF radio. And as I mentioned before, there are more than a few somewhat compromised antennas that are capable of multiband, but they are compromised. TS-440 might have enough oomph in its antenna tuner, but it might not be. My understanding of Japanese antenna tuners are that if you're close to tuning, 3-to-1 or better, then not that bad. But if you really want something that will tune a doorknob, like I have, then I would suggest that you get something with a little bit more oomph. Third-party antenna tuners, either manual or automated, many of them are capable of as much as 10-to-1. mismatch correction. So you might need something with a little bit more tuning capability depending upon what kind of antenna you finally choose.
Okay. Tell Paul I paid
$100
with the power supply. I wonder if I paid too much or not enough.
I don't know. Paul, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just wondering about the antenna tuner. He won't need another one. It's pretty forgiving. I've gone up to like 4-to-1, and it's tuned 4-to-1, which is not bad. But if you cut the antennas to the right size, if you're putting up your own dipole, or if you buy a commercial one, it's pretty good. It will cover, if it says, 10 meters, you're going to get the whole 10-meter band, I had the whole 10-meter band all the way up to the high end of 10 meters where you got FM. By the way, that radio does FM as well. You might want to try that, a couple of months from now when you get used to it. That was a lot of fun. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Back to you, Roy.
Okay,
yeah,
thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, there was a guy who was about 95% noise. If you could either raise the output or play around with the antenna somehow or move onto a hill and try again, because I couldn't really make out your voice. I just heard a human being, but it was not intelligible, too much noise. So try again.
Is that better? I just wanted to say thank you, guys.
I was reading mail, listening to the station asking what type of antenna. But yet there's no mention of that verticals, no mention of that beams, jagging. I'm just wondering why all those goodies were left out.
Stu, because he wants a multi-band.
Well, I have a multi-band beam. I have a tri-band beam. And I had a vertical that went from, 10 meters up to at least 80 meters. If that's not multi-band, I don't know what is.
Well, Charlie was kind of intimating he wanted it all, which is kind of difficult to do under any form. I really didn't get into the differences between vertical orientation or horizontal orientation. There's a lot of different things, but I wouldn't consider a three-band Yagi that would require him to then get a rotor and then deal with that and such to be kind of the way he kind of presented that he wants all of HF. To me, all of HF is not three bands, but, your mileage might vary.
Well, I had a vertical antenna that went from 10 to 80 meters. And there was no mention about it, and perhaps the station was not aware of it. But unless they stopped manufacturing them, I've been in this hobby since 1960, and I've had all kinds of antennas, but clearly, it's a lot easier to put up a vertical to go from 10 to 80, and there's no doubt that that constitutes multi-band. And I can't imagine anyone really wanting to operate on 160. That is a very specialized spectrum of the frequency.
I would agree with you, the 160, but I alluded to TRAPS, which is probably your multi-band vertical uses stubs and traps to get through all of the bands. It requires a little bit of maintenance. Usually, traps have been known to go bad over time, so you need to kind of maintain them a little bit. But I did allude to traps. Again, you could go on and on for the next half hour mentioning all kinds of varied multi-band antenna designs out there.
Well, there's no need to go on for a half hour. Clearly, it took about 10 to 15 seconds to suggest a vertical or a beam. That opens up all kinds types of vistas for people who are looking for other types of antennas. I just thought it was a little bit odd. The big, long discussion about all types of wires and this and that and traps. That's all well and good if that's what you like. But I've had tri-band beams and I've had vertical antennas that took nothing to put up. And I'm not suggesting that the operator should do so. I'm only saying that he should at least be apprised of his choices that have not been corrected. That's all. That was not a federal case.
Okay, Stu, you comprised him. So, Charlie, I wish you the best. If you ever have any other questions, feel free to come back and discuss it with the crowd here. Like I said, there are many, many different varieties of things that you can try, and it's a learning process. What works best for you. There are some people who pick particular designs and particularly have had good luck with them, and so they continue to go back to them, and there are others that rotate through every imaginable thing written up in antenna books. So I wish you luck.
Thank you very much, Roy. You've been a big help.
And Roy, which power supply did he get? Did he get the PS50 power supply?
Charlie?
The power supply that came with it.
Yeah, that's the Legatank PS50. It took me about, I don't know, 30 years to constant use. It finally gave up the ghost, and I bought another one. But that is a well-built power supply. Oh, very good.
Yeah, this thing is heavy. I mean, heavy for a power supply.
I agree. It quit. I just can't throw it out. I mean, I just love that thing. I always dreamt of repairing it, but that never happened. Roy, over to you, WS2S.
Okay, very good. Charlie, once again, I wish you luck. And again, if you have any questions or ideas or problems or what have you, feel free to bring it here, and the crowd can probably help you out with ideas or solutions or something. The sky is the limit. You know, if you don't want to do it yourself, which is fine, if you want to buy a store-bought type of antenna, you know, pull up a catalog from DX and thumb through it. There's all kinds of models of beams and verticals and horizontals and Yagis and gaps and all kinds of ways of getting your signal out. And then you can kind of look it up, Google it on the internet, and see what suits you. You know, verticals are okay, especially if you have ways to keep them aloft, guy wires or something. If you can't guy wire them, that might be a problem. A dipole is a well-used type of antenna that needs three connection points. So, you know, find something that's suitable for your location. You want it on the roof, but, you know, how many places can you kind of tie it down? Can you tie it down to the side of the roof, or is it when the roof ends, your support system dies? You know, that can affect also what kind of antenna would work best for you, because you want to keep that antenna up in the air as much as possible. If you don't support it correctly, a strong wind blows and the thing goes down, and then you have to start from scratch. So there's a lot of little considerations to make when you're planning something that suits your particular elevation and location and desires for frequencies. Okay, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limar Technical Med. If anyone has any amateur radio-related questions, comments, or topics, please ID, give me a call sign, and your first name. Okay, hopefully. hopefully as time progresses, there'll be a little bit more action going on. So, Wes, on to you. What can I do you for today, Wes?
Yeah, I have five topics with news and science, and one topic very easy. So let me start from the easy one. And the easy one, describe Charles Kimball a waveguide. Back to you.
Say again, all I caught was the waveguide word.
Is a coaxial cable considered to be a waveguide? Is it a waveguide?
I don't know if it's strictly considered a waveguide. It's a transmission line. Waveguides are considered transmission lines, but I don't know if you can define a coaxial cable as an actual waveguide. It doesn't strike me as consistent with the general characteristics of things that I've called waveguides before.
Okay, so I'm going to try to take the other position just for the case of it. The coaxial cable and the older classic waveguide is still in use. Then another question would be, what is a classic waveguide? And a coaxial cable is a waveguide. And the reason for it is, coaxial cables technically are counted as a waveguide, but generally they are not referred as such. Waveguides can be constructed using conductive or dielectric materials, and the coaxial cable has one. And the wave doesn't travel on the wire, it travels in the space between the dielectric and conductor. And as far as the classic waveguide, that would be the question that is directed to you, but first, when we distinguish between the transmission line and the waveguide, it is important to know that a transmission line, a two-conductor structure, can support TEM wave, and other, on the other hand, a waveguide, a one-conductor structure, can only support TE and TM. But that would actually be me contradicting myself, so please, Dr. Roy, explain it.
Well, again, unfortunately, we're open to the interpretation of words. I mean, maybe in a real loose interpretation, you can describe it as a waveguide, but again, I wouldn't, because it doesn't have the modes that what I think waveguides have. So, and, you know, there is conductance on the surface of the conducting surface. Coaxial cables, the phenomena is not solely in the cavity. It's going on because of the skin effect on the outer surface, the inner surface of the shield, and the outer surface of the center wire is the differential mode, and the outer surface of the shield is the common mode. So that's not a function of dielectric, that's a function of the conductor. So again, it's a little bit in my way of using the terminology different from a waveguide enough to say that, in my mind, I don't consider it a waveguide.
VDH with a comment.
Sure, John.
Well, actually, coaxial cable supports the TEM mode all the way down to DC. Okay, the TEM mode has no fields, no electrical or magnetic fields in the direction of propagation. Okay, now, I guess what we always consider as waveguide modes are either the TE mode or the TM mode. Those modes have a component of field in the direction of propagation, and they don't work down to DC. So you can consider the coaxial cable as a TEM mode waveguide. Also, you can take a coaxial cable. If you go up high enough, you can start to propagate TE modes and TM modes to avoid that. That's why you notice that coaxial cable that's used for a very high frequency, like up in the microwaves, is very thin, because they want to make sure that none of those waveguide, those TE or TM modes get stimulated. They want to make sure it stays in the TEM mode. Go ahead.
Okay, but I mean, ultimately, push comes to shove, the average guy who plays with these things, if you burrow back to the electrodynamic origin of all these things, there's a commonality. But I don't know, would you ever really ultimately in your day-to-day life think of coaxial cables as waveguides?
Yeah, the electric field is radial, going from center conductor to the outer braid, and the magnetic field is circular, encircling the center conductor, and it vanishes outside of the outer braid. But there is no component in the direction of propagation.
What about common mode?
Well, when you say common mode, you're talking about a component of current that's on the inner surface. But between the inner and outer conductors, the electric field is radial and the magnetic field is circular. If you're driving, trying to drive a balanced load without a balance or something like that, you can get unbalanced currents, but the fields are still the electric field is still radial and the magnetic field is still circular. There still is no component of current in the direction of propagation.
Okay, but I mean all transmission lines have some degree of common mode current going on. Is there a similar type of common mode transmission of current going on the type of cavities that I consider the real thing, or am I just just simplifying it too much to the point where I'm just wrong?
Well, I think we all think about, when we start thinking waveguides, like we think of a piece of WR90, with a rectangular waveguide, and the dominant mode everybody thinks of is TE10. So that has the electric field peaks in the middle, and as it propagates down, as Dick used to say, it sort of zigzags down there, but there is a component that's in the direction. If it's TE, you have a component of magnetic field that's in the direction of propagation. That's why they sometimes call TE mode, they sometimes refer to it as H mode, and likewise TM mode, they sometimes call it E mode. But again, in coaxial cables, there is no component of field that's in the direction of propagation. They refer to that mode as TEM.
Good. Okay, so the waveguides that I think of waveguides have slightly different characteristics than what I consider just transmission lines, but for the sake of electrical engineering, they're both some version of waveguides. So I guess that's your answer, Wesley.
Thank you very much. I do not intend to give up so easy, so I have a question for both of you, but first I'm going to just say a few words about the mode. So TEM mode exhibits neither electric nor magnetic fields in direction of propagation and cannot be propagated in the waveguide. So both of the H and E vectors are perpendicular to the propagation of direction. The TE mode transfer electric mode, no electric field in the direction of propagation, and this configuration is occasionally named the H mode, at least as far as I recall it. So there is a present only magnetic field aligned along the direction of propagation. And the transverse magnetic mode, TM mode, that would be no magnetic field in direction of propagation. So sometimes it is referred as the E mode, indicating the existence of electric field aligned along the direction of propagation. I hope I didn't make a mistake on it. But we're talking about the wire, electrical wire covered with the Teflon, so not a traditional coaxial cable, but wire connected, covered with the Teflon. Sometimes it was used using high voltage for one wire transmission line. It's in Wikipedia. That is actually a waveguide. So, would you please, both of you, correct me if I'm wrong?
I think the first half of what you said was just restating what John said. So I'll give it over to John. I think you're alluding to G-lines and such as transmission lines. Well, we used to talk about them in transmission lines, but tonight you want to talk about them in terms of waveguides as well. So, John, I'd be interested in your opinion of what Wesley said and G-lines and such. Do they count as waveguides as well? I would assume so.
Wesley, I think you're referring to the Gavot line. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but yes, G-line. It's a single-wire transmission line. It has a launching mechanism, and the modes that it propagates don't go down to DC, as I understand it, right, because it is a single wire. So, as I understand it, it does have a component of the field in the direction of propagation. Now, don't quote me on that, though, but I'm pretty sure that because it doesn't go down to DC, it is not propagating a TEM mode. Usually any structure that can propagate down to DC, like a two-wire structure, coaxial cable, or a power open wire, will go down to DC, will support a TEM mode, that is, have no component of field in the direction of propagation. That's how I understand it. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's how I understand it.
Yes, I was talking about the G-line of Mr. Gobel. Gobel, there is a different way of pronunciation of the name, but he was famous in 1955. Mr. Gobel, he made the one-wire transmission of electrical energy of the electromagnetic signal whatsoever. We're not going to the specific audit. And the last question, that was the classic waveguide. What is the classic waveguide, Dr. Roy?
Well, we have John here. I'll throw it over to him as well.
Well, when you say classic waveguide, if I consider WR90, which is used from 8 to 12 gigahertz, that will not propagate down to DC, obviously, because it's just one pipe, okay? It's just one wire, so there's no way you can send DC through it, okay? It has a lower cutoff frequency. WR90, I did a little experiment. It cuts off around 6.5 gigahertz. Around 6.5, 6.6 is where it cuts off, and if you take it above 12, it starts to go into the next mode, which is why people don't take WR90 much higher than about 11 gigahertz or so. Beyond 12, when you get up to 12 or 13 gigahertz, I think it goes into the next mode of support. I think it's TM11, but don't quote me on that. But I know it only supports the dominant mode, TE10, is pretty much used from about 8 to 11 gigahertz. So go ahead.
Yeah, actually, the answer was created much before we all born. Okay, and that was a metal pipe that was used for the first waveguides, and actually German were pretty good in it during World War II. So from that point, there was a terminology of the metal tube as a classical waveguide or classic waveguide. So the frequency, they weren't near by gigahertz at that time, but the waveguides that I saw from that time were somewhere in frequency of 150 to 300 megahertz.
What diameter pipe was that?
Humongous. Yes.
2CC?
Yes.
Hi, it's yes,
2CC, Brian, on the site.
Oh, okay, Brian, welcome to the net. Usually the way things work is we go down our list of people with questions, and we run out. I ask for new people. So when we're done with Wesley, I guess I'll call on you. How's that?
Sounds like a plan. Thank you.
A2FTP Vault.
Yes, Chris?
Hi, Roy. I got a quick question for John and or yourself on the subject. The TM and TE modes, is there any way you can explain what those are, or what kind of mode we're referring to a layman like myself? And I would understand if it's really not possible to explain it non-technically, but some type of we're referring to. I'm guessing it's a transmission mode within the transmission cable or waveguide in this case. Is that correct, or what are we talking about?
This is WA2VDH. Let me see if I have it. The TM and TE refers to transverse electric for TE and transverse magnetic for TM. And what usually the number that follows that is the number of half-wave variations across the wide measurement of the waveguide. So like TE10 in WR90 would mean that there is a half-wave variation, one half-wave variation across the wide width of the waveguide, because the waveguide is rectangular. Usually the rectangular measurements are in the ratio of 2 to 1. So across the wide width, if it's TE10, would mean there's one half wave variation across the that wide width of the waveguide. That's the notation as I understand it. Go ahead.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. K2FTP.
Yeah, during the SpaceNet report, I'll thumb through Google, see if there's a nice illustration for something like that.
A comment?
One other quick question. You were talking about 8 and 10, 12 gigahertz. What goes on up there? What are they using those frequencies for? I assume some crazy, nutty stuff like MRIs or something.
I think there's a lot of cell tower activity going on there.
We got a ham band up there.
For now, I'm a little bit concerned what the future will hold. But these are bands that industry has kind of decided are worth something, and so you got to be very careful. I think there's some move afoot for some company to grab a bigger slice out of those areas.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Lloyd.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, the present technology doesn't really care much about HF, thankfully, so we're sort of safe. But we're not safe in the gigahertz. The gigahertz is far too valuable for the guys in Washington.
Isn't the propagation so poor up that high that I don't understand how it's so useful to them?
Yeah, Paul, one second. It's mostly point-to-point contact, you know, things like cell towers and such. That's why they're built every other block, because the propagation is awful, but penetration is possible and incredibly wide bandwidth are possible. Paul?
8 gigs is real. Used for a lot of transmissions in space back to Earth. You know, that's a very popular band. So, you know, I mean, some of the ones from deep space, you know, Mars, and even the Voyagers, they're transmitting back in, on that frequency back to Earth.
Yeah, I mean, as far as frequency spectrum is concerned, the only thing that works as far as ionospheric propagation is 6 meters, sometimes during sunspot activity and below. So, I mean, all of the UHF, VHF, and microwaves are kind of all point-to-point contact-based transmissions.
A comment?
Certainly, John.
I remember Dick used to talk about having some real long distance QSOs on 10 gig due to ionospheric ducting, or there are some very strange modes of propagation that occur up there. But I remember he used to talk about having QSOs with some people down in the Carolinas on a regular basis on 10 gigahertz.
Okay, that doesn't ring any bell in my head. I remember him having a conversation when he commuted from upstate New York, but those were, I think, UHF, VHF frequencies. I'm not aware of that. I mean, as far as I'm aware, the distance records that are made usually are based with two guys standing on top of either mountains or very high hills.
YWS2N.
Yes, Paul.
That's true. That's true about Dick with 10 gigahertz. In fact, a couple times he came out here to Ronkonkoma, where there's parking. You know, they had a full change now, but he used to go up to the upper deck where the parking lot was and transmit with 10 gig on that. And then he had it at home, and he would, I think he said 300 milliwatts, some really low power, and he had a regular QSO with I believe it was a guy in Virginia, you know, anytime there was a particular band opening on 10 gigs, back to yours.
Oh, okay, I missed those conversations, I guess. I wasn't aware that the ionosphere is capable of refracting at those frequencies. I thought they all could just kind of go straight through them and into space, but I have to kind of look that stuff up again.
It was ducting, not the ionosphere.
Okay, so it was a thermal inversion? It was kind of on the surface of the water and such? Is it a thermosphere?
Yeah, strictly ducting. What is it, temperature inversion? That type of thing.
For me, ducting is like internal reflection. Do you agree with that, Dr. Roy?
Well, it's another form of refraction. What happens is a thermal inversion And so electromagnetic waves get refracted in the same way that they get refracted in the ionosphere, except that it's a much lower thermosphere layer that's doing it, and it's all due to a thermal inversion due to weather patterns.
Can I go to the next one?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to try to speed up. Otto Lilienthal. Otto Lilienthal. So, on August 1896, there was a guy who tried to do something which was 12 years before Wright Brothers, the flight December 17, 1903, and he built a structure that looks like the wings of the bird, and he could move it with his hands, and he was trying to fly with it. There was a glider, and he his glider got stalled, and he was unable to regain the control, falling from 15 meters, which is 49 feet. He broke his neck and died next day. Now, if we take to consideration 1896, and then we take 12 years later, 1903, Wright Brothers, they made it, and then we see September 26, 1973, Concorde, French Concorde, first of transatlantic crossing, at a super incredible speed, never met. I mean, I don't know if it's never met before, supersonic. Okay, how fast it goes. And of course, during the First World War and the Second World War, we had the planes, and the Germans made a lot of progress in it. Let me jump. Okay, the German Center of Aviation and Space Research, SDR, had ambition plan to reconstruct the glider of Otto Lilienthal. The scientists wanted to prove that first construction was reliable and real, able to fly. So one of its specialists even wanted more than that. He wanted to fly on this originally reconstructed glider. And a documentary that was made on the YouTube, I hope Dr. Roy decides to put it on his webpage, actually shows that 7 seconds of eternity, it was working. Dr. Roy.
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to here.
Oh, that was the YouTube that I have sent you showing that scientists actually flying the original, I mean, the copy, the reconstruction of original Otto Lilienthal, the apparatus. Back to you.
Okay, when did you send that? Because I don't recall seeing that particular one. I saw a bunch of other things. I saw something about Skunk Works, but not that one.
It is EN Otto Lilienthal, first flight, 7 seconds to for eternity. It was sent August 26, 2024 at 18 p.m., which was 6 days ago, to you and to Paul. Back to you.
Okay, I'll look for it. I don't remember it.
One is green, no pollution energy for NASA space agents, i.e. I would need Paul also to assist us with that. So it's CO2 free fuel for industry. And then what it says is that it could be used in space. So in other words, we have the University, Technical University in Bavaria, Eindhoven, together with Center's Family Brewers and Metal Powder Consortium. And they actually made a iron powder furnace that is delivering the power, is able to power the devices, or provide the power for satellites, or provide the power.